the pandemic really changed the healthcare industry forever. Now more than ever, providers and care teams, clinicians, staff, they all rely on technology to communicate, but retailers are in a completely different world.
So could you talk a little bit about sort of your strategy for bringing people together to solve problems?
And you really have to understand all of the components that are required to work together.
What's the philosophy on engagement that your team holds in order to get all these moving pieces together? Is there one, or does it have to be one?
Look, yes, there is one. Yes, there has to be one. That's not the only thing, though. When we build the Retail Edge solution and we take it to any one of those brands that I just referenced, we have to understand them. Do you have a number of retailers in the United Kingdom that may share an ecosystem?
First, thank you for even taking the time to click and listen to this podcast. If you know how you found out about it, if it was on Twitter, if it was on Instagram, if it was on Facebook, if a friend of yours shared the podcast link, just think about that and see if you're interested in sharing this with someone else. If you like what you hear, and hopefully they like what they hear too, then we can grow. And this is really the only way we grow. So think about it. We'd love to get more audience, and we'd love to make other people feel like you've given them value. So let's go. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good. Today is a good day. It is.
It's actually afternoon where I am, by the way.
Okay.
It's bright and early over
9
there.
9 a.m. 9:06 a.m. Yes.
Sorry to drag you out.
That's
you
okay. Know? You know what? I like this. I like having conversations. So this is great.
I'm going to introduce you here. For those who don't know, this is Jacqueline Morgan. She is currently the VP of Industry at VMware. She's a board member at a pet therapy place, which I think is very interesting. And she's been head of industry at Cognizant. So she's been in industry for quite a long time. And I think I'm lucky to be able to speak to her here and learn a little bit from her as well. And I hope you guys do too. Welcome to the RH Podcast.
Excellent. Let's get into it.
Yeah. You know, for those who don't know, what does a VP of industry at a company do?
Let's talk about the team and what the teams do. Because what happens in the software world is our software is complicated. And particularly for us at VMware, everybody raced to this multi-cloud journey. And really, thank you, COVID, created a lot of cloud chaos. And so now that we're kind of coming out the backside of that, many companies, many of our customers are stepping back and saying, I need to refine how all of my on-prem hyperscaler components work. And I need somebody that knows me, knows my industry, understands what I'm trying to do and what my competitors are already doing, help me stay ahead of the curve. And so that's where individuals with industry solutions, backgrounds, a depth and breadth of understanding of the workflows, the processes, the regulatory environments by geography. That's really important when you're trying to go from cloud chaos to cloud smart.
Fantastic. So is that something where for each industry, you go in, learn about it, or are you in charge of a particular industry and then sort of consistently onboard members of that industry into your solutions?
Yeah, it's really about bringing individuals who have a depth and breadth of experience in industry. So I focus primarily on financial services, healthcare and life sciences, and retail. So if you take a look at banks, they want to modernize their IT infrastructure. They want to drive operational agility, top line growth and security, all at scale around the world. And they use our digital foundation. So we have individuals on our financial services industry team who know how to build, run, manage, connect, and protect any app on any cloud on any device. The outcome of that is to help our financial services and insurance customers to drive better customer experience, better employee experience, protect everybody's data, and really improve the trust across the industry. In healthcare, it's slightly different. In healthcare, I have a group of very talented and experienced healthcare SMEs that appreciate that the pandemic really changed the healthcare industry forever. Now more than ever, providers and care teams, clinicians, staff, they all rely on technology to communicate, to diagnose, to treat, and to stand up new services at a moment's notice. And they need to be able to do that quickly. But retailers are in a completely different world. You know, they're trying to innovate faster. They're trying to keep up with customers and the experiences that you and I are demanding. They have to do that while they're proactively managing legacy retail infrastructure. So even something as simple as those point of sale terminals that we're all very accustomed to using, they can be constrained by legacy systems behind the scenes that our team, based on what they know about living and breathing retail every day, can help them evolve. Just a couple of examples. We have energy individuals in VMware. We have people who focus on manufacturing and automotive. We have civil and defense, telco. But the three that I focus on are those retail, healthcare, and financial services and insurance. Yeah.
Right. So if we go based on basically one industry at a time, what was interesting to me, I guess, in what you said was how exactly do you tackle something like retail, right? Because I think that speaks to even my personal experiences, you know, these point of sale systems. And it's hard to think about all the changes that have happened, or at least even over the last 10 years, and how those point of sale systems, as they haven't changed, but a lot has changed on the back end necessarily of those retail conglomerate or businesses. How do you maintain that older system and newer system and all the complexities that comes with, right? Because every new thing you introduce interacts with a set of new things, and that increases the number of interactions and increases the complexity. So do you lose value every time that happens because you've introduced complexity? And how do you manage that?
So yes, everything that you just said. And now layer in the complexity of you walk into a store, you stand in front of a mirror and you take a shirt and you hold it in front of the mirror, and the mirror now displays that shirt on your body in the mirror, and you can touch the mirror, and you can determine if that shirt is in stock in your size in that store or another store, and if it's not, what is available. Once you do that, you start to kick off an entire ecosystem of additional parties that are helping that store deliver that experience to you in that moment. But you want to order that shirt, and that shirt is at a store 200 miles away. That shirt's going to be delivered in a box in 2 or 3 days. What has to happen in the back end in order to execute on that experience that you expect to have and millions of other consumers expect to have is really quite extraordinary, because the level of integrations between not just the retailers and not just their back end, not just their edge technology in the store in that moment, but everything that they need to support behind the scenes from a supply chain and a partner ecosystem perspective is really quite remarkable. And so when our retail team shows up to talk to a Walmart, a Lowe's, a Loblaws, or Marks and Spencer, they have to understand that entire ecosystem, that each retailer is actually kind of uniquely trying to evolve, because the strength of the ecosystem of all those partners and how well they work together is the competitive differentiator. Well, when we build solutions, when we build those retail solutions, when we build the retail edge solution or the point of sale modernization solution, and we take it to any one of those brands that I just referenced, we have to understand them. We have to understand them very specifically and very uniquely, and how they operate and what their ecosystem looks like. Now, do you have a number of retailers in the United Kingdom that may share an ecosystem? Absolutely. But they're also delivering globally. Most retail brands are global. When we go to work with Canadian Tire, we need to understand very specifically the ecosystem that they work in geographically, but also more broadly. So we look at the solution and we create it with the workflows and the specifics of the industry in mind. But then the real magic comes when we sit down with our account teams, with our field sellers and our partners, and say, okay, very specifically, in this unique environment, it's actually going to look like this. It's not a one size fits all. It's not the Henry Ford, everybody gets a black car. That doesn't work. And the same thing happens in healthcare. I mean, even at a much larger scale, with a much more diverse ecosystem, payer, provider, US, Norway, Australia, even thinking about how you deliver to healthcare services providers in Asia Pacific, that ecosystem is even more diverse. And the regulations are much more significant. Think about all those different geographies from a healthcare perspective.
But specifically in healthcare, it's more regulations, which makes sense.
Right. The regulatory environment for retail is, I would say, less complex than a regulatory and global regulatory environment for healthcare services providers and for life sciences as well. You really have to be able to bring a depth and breadth of not just subject matter expertise to the table in the industry for each individual customer, but also understanding localized regional differences and nuances that are going to impact your ecosystem.
So you talked a bit about, at least on the healthcare side, the need to spontaneously spin up resources. Is that unique to healthcare? I mean, no. I'm sure this scaling, but is there something about healthcare where you mentioned that? Or is that just in general? I would assume it is in general for retail because there are seasonal purchases.
Absolutely.
Interesting that healthcare has that as well. Why would it have that?
Well, think about what we just went through, right? Think about what we all just went through globally, is that at a moment's notice, and the result of the pandemic has, I'll give you a personal example. My father-in-law was recently diagnosed with cancer. Now, my mother 13 years ago had leukemia. So I've kind of been on this journey before. I've experienced the clinical environment that you need to walk through with someone who's on that path. And I spent yesterday afternoon at my father-in-law's house, marveling at the fact that he was having a consult with the oncologist and the surgeon about his particular situation remotely. Now, the appointment was delayed 45 minutes. My experience with my mom years ago was that you had to go to the hospital and you had to sit in the hospital waiting room and bring some snacks and a warm blanket because you're going to be there for a while. I mean, everybody's trying to do their best that they can. You see the person, you see the oncologist and the surgeon when you see them. The experience has fundamentally changed because of remote patient access, because clinicians are now able to communicate, diagnose, treat, and leverage those new service moments as an outcome of how we all walked through the pandemic together. People have said, I don't want to come in. I don't want to have to go sit in the room and wait. I'd rather wait. I'm already sick. I'd rather wait in the comfort of my own home, walk to my own fridge and get a snack and sit on the couch and wait for you to be available. Thank you very much. And hospitals and clinical environments have to respond in that way. They have to be able to provide that. And then, of course, they have to manage all of the complexities around electronic medical records and privacy and data and security while providing that kind of experience. And also, many of those clinicians and care providers might also be working remotely. So it's complicated. It's wonderful from a customer, from an individual perspective, that the care has transitioned into this much more human experience of how we support people who are ill, but it's very complicated to serve behind the scenes.
So what I'm sort of digesting is a lot of industries are leveraging technology to facilitate convenience for different purposes. So for retail, mm-hmm. it's a more convenient experience on making a selection. For healthcare, it's a more convenient service provisioning. And I would just also assume that in finance, for different mm-hmm. reasons, with different kinds of regulatory concerns, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. sort of the same thing. I guess, is there overlap? Because I would assume that with healthcare, the regulation is that you're going to slap on and the security you're going to slap on is going to be a lot different from finance. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, and maybe the scaling concerns will be a little bit different because the reasons why people go to or ask for an account in a bank and the reasons why people want to see a doctor. For seeing a doctor is definitely more of a spontaneous thing, like you just talked about with COVID. And in general, people don't plan to get sick, but people kind of know when they want to get a house. So there'll be some scaling concerns, but the fundamental experience of making a call and talking to someone on the technology side is essentially going to be the same. So are there opportunities for overlap in solutioning that you guys are leveraging and sort of packaging things for different industries in different ways, but there are units that you can sort of put together and are sure that will work in several places? Does that make sense?
Yes, but let me go back to when you started this question. You used a word that I kind of went, I'm not sure that is the word I agree with. And that's the word convenience. And I would say the word is not broad enough. It's about expectations, your expectations, my expectations, expectations of individuals that are older than both you and I, and expectations of people that are younger than both you and I, expectations of regulators, governments, politicians, expectations of corporations, right? We have a different set of expectations that we are being required to line up behind serving. The experience that we all want to have, and how quickly, thank you very much, Amazon, we want to have things, services provided to us. You can take a look at the financial services industry. They've done an absolutely amazing job of providing us with the hat trick, if you're Canadian, if you're a hockey player, the trifecta of security, trust at scale. Anytime, wherever you want, sending money to anyone around the world safely, securely. When's the last time you walked into a bank? When's the last time you paid cash for anything? I remember somebody actually asked me for cash. They preferred to have cash. I kind of looked at them and thought, I don't even remember the last time that I had cash in my pocket. And how well they've been able to meet those expectations over time. And look at, you can buy crypto on PayPal. So everybody in the financial services industry in particular is constantly adapting and readapting at scale around the world. So certain industries are really leading the charge. Financial services is a big one. And healthcare is also another big one. And retail, that's why we focus on those three as the kind of global industries. Because yes, from a customer experience, from a complexity, and from a regulatory point of view, they're all incredibly unique in terms of what they demand. But you're right, there are pieces and parts of the fundamentals that we can get right on the back end from an infrastructure point of view that our product teams deeply understand. But it's all the nuances of those other components that really differentiate, certainly us, when we show up and talk about.
No, absolutely. And those challenges, there are so many of them that it seems to dwarf any sort of overlap because it's such a unique experience to provide that kind of value for each individual industry.
Right, by geography.
Right. And so when you talked about expectations, in my mind, I was thinking, did you expect to sort of be in this industry? Sort of how did you get started in coming into technology? And then from there, seeing this challenge and saying, this is where I sort of want to be and how I want to contribute. So could you just tell us a little bit about your story?
I started really this part of my career and this part of my journey in software as a consultant. So I've worked with Accenture, I've worked with IBM, I've worked at Cognizant, KPMG. And one of the great things about being a consultant is that you get to solve a lot of different problems. And your clients really rely on you to bring them the best of an industry, of what other people are doing. What are my competitors doing? Who's out there doing it really well? What do I need to avoid? What are the mistakes and the pitfalls that others have made that I'm paying you to help me be mindful of? And what are the best practices? What are the strategies that we're really seeing success and traction around the world? And as I worked over the last lot of years as a consultant in multiple industries, you get a sense and a real depth of understanding for not just the problems and not just the solutions, but how incredibly complicated it is to actually deliver those in a very specific client environment. And then you transition into a software as a service company like VMware, and the complications are not any less. Now you really have to translate how to solve for all of that complexity from very specifically from your product set, from the solutions that you have in your back pocket. And interestingly enough, part of what my team does is we work very close with global systems integrators, like the ones that I used to work for. We work very closely with hyperscalers, and we work very closely, as I described in that retail example, with the unique ISVs for each of those independent software vendors, right? So each of the unique, every industry kind of has their own unique, and every customer almost has their own very specific set of an ecosystem of solution partners that they work with. And so it's ironic that even today, working in a software as a service company, I still spend a lot of time with GSIs, consultants. I still spend a lot of time with hyperscalers. And everybody's really focused on how do we solve for this problem and this complexity with this particular customer.
Is there something about you that made it so that you felt like this is a challenge that you want to continue sort of attacking? Or is it just something you felt like you fell into and just kept going with and rolling with?
It feels like a natural evolution.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like it.
Yeah, because if you think about what problem solvers do, right? You have to be able to take very complicated issues and break them down into the components that are solvable, discern how to solve them. And then nobody does it by themselves, right? What are the partners internal to your organization or external to the customer's within the customer's organization? Who are the partners that need to kind of come together to solve it? Now you know problem resolution. You know what the answer is. Right. Actually solving it, that's the hard part. Actually orchestrating everyone to really kind of move forward from where we know the solution, where we want to get to actually delivering that, there's a lot of things that can go sideways.
So, and that's really interesting because you talk a lot about your team, you know, how they're a big part of, you know, making sure that a lot of these, I would say, moving pieces, and there seems to be a lot of them, actually get executed. Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit about sort of your strategy for bringing people together to solve problems, especially, I guess, in your case where it's a new problem every season? How do you, there's going to be a cycle on bringing people in, getting them to understand and then execute, but there still has to be a way that the team works and residual context that also has to be transferred when new team members come in and out. So how are you able to make that happen?
I put on my United Nations Blue Beret, right? And I jest about that, but it's really important to be the...
Do you work with a lot of partners internationally? And a lot of your teams are from lots of different places?
Yes. And you really have to understand all of the components that are required to work together to deliver the solution to this particular customer to solve this particular problem. And what are everybody's unique interests? Sometimes you work with people whose capabilities you wouldn't necessarily have, we wouldn't necessarily have chosen them, but our customer has chosen them. Our customer has said, this is my preferred partner for X. Now, maybe we wouldn't have chosen that particular partner for X, but our customer did. And so obviously they have a certain level of competence and capability. Otherwise, the customer would not have chosen them. But now we need to understand what is it that organization, that company brings to the table, capabilities, what's real about it, we all have a little bit of lip gloss put on, you know, our marketing spin on what we can do and how we can do it. So what's real and how do they get paid? That's important for us to understand. We have to understand what motivates other organizations in this ecosystem. Why are they coming to the table to participate in this, solving this problem? What's in it for them? What do they need to get out of this? Because if we can solution and identify where this solution meets their needs, it's a much easier conversation to have to bring them in, to incentivize them to start down this path with us. And they're much more willing to invest their time, money, and resources to make this, solving this problem successful. And they're much more willing to work with the other partners in the ecosystem. Because sometimes you can have organizations in a solution that are actually competitors.
And if you'd have that, what happens? Because that's an interesting problem to solve when it comes to bringing people together. Because you don't have control over who it comes in always, right?
Correct.
How do you solve that?
Correct. You have to understand from a technical perspective, from a process perspective. Again, it goes back to how are folks getting paid? How are they going to make money solving for this problem? And so where's their lane? Where do they need to exist in the execution of this solution? And how do you make sure folks really understand their lane? Now, you're always going to have people who are going to try to, I don't know, NASCAR their way into somebody else's lane. But that's part of what we help to align.
Right. How do you coach your team to have this sort of understanding, expectation, and deal with you know, sort of what's the philosophy on engagement that your team holds in order to get all these moving pieces together? Is there one, or does it have to be one?
Yeah, there has to be one. Yes and yes. So yes, there is one. Yes, there has to be one. I think that it has to be about focus. It has to be about focus and being very, very mindful of the customer's problem to be solved. Everything has to relate back to the customer. So that's when you keep the customer at the and the problem that they want to solve, right? The why at the center of what you're doing, you bring everybody back to it. And honestly, that's what the customer wants you to do. Okay, so that's not the only thing though, right? That focus on the customer isn't going to kumbaya your way into having everybody get along. So you have to keep the solution as simple as possible. Because everybody can want to layer on complexity on top of complexity in an already complex situation very quickly. So you're constantly having to kind of break apart what you've put together and say, you know, how can we make this car go faster? How can we make it lighter? How can we make it more agile? How can we make sure that this solution, we don't over-architect it, because you have a single use case, right? You have a single problem that you're trying to solve, and you can very easily start to bump up against adjacencies, adjacent problems. Like, oh, but you know, this thing that we did here, if we just tweaked or refined or layered this partner's solution in, we could also solve for this other problem. And don't get me wrong, sometimes we end up doing that, but I'd say 8 times out of 10, we don't. Because there's so many partners involved in solving the problem, and everybody needs to get paid at the end of the day. Everybody needs to know what's in it for them, and the customer needs to know that it's actually going to work. It's much more useful to solve for a single problem. So how do you do that? It comes down, this is probably the hardest part. It's trust. It sounds so ridiculous and simplistic, but knowing how to communicate and understanding where other partners, other people are coming from, right? How's that guy over there who works for X company and this nice young lady over here who works for Y company, how are they going to get their bonus at the end of this solving for this problem? If you do understand that, you can have conversations with them and their organizations about their role and their participation. They're going to actually hear what you have to say. Because if they don't think that there's anything in it for them, they're not going to show up. So our subject matter experts, my team, in addition to being industry subject matter experts, are masterful communicators. Sometimes they're magicians, and they can, it's not an algorithm, it's more alchemy. They're able to help bring all of the various partners together in a way that serves everybody's interests and ultimately gets solution implemented to solve the customer problem. And the other thing, yeah, too, we don't focus on 27 solutions in a year. We focus on 3 and a quarter. Yes. This is not at scale, right? We're not solutioning and throwing solutions out based and being rewarded by our organization based on the number of solutions that we put out in market. It's about the quality, not the quantity. Are they adopted? Are they actually used? That's the measure of our success as a team.
It's very non-perishable products almost. So you talked about your team being masterful communicators. Is there something unique about their approach to communication? And just don't get me wrong. I heard you when it comes to aligning incentives is sort of what I heard when we're talking to partners, making sure that everyone's driving on the same road, going in the same direction at minimum. And that's in terms of their incentives. And also, of course, making sure that road that everyone's driving towards is also leading towards getting the customer what they want, because that's ultimately the point. But there is a lot of nuance in, especially with communication, getting the fact that this is your incentive, because you talked about trust and you need to build trust, and build trust is built slowly.
Yes.
And if you're doing four products over time, exactly, doing 4 products a year or 3.5, that's 3 months to build trust, communicate that your own intentions, 3 months to get that person's incentive, align it. And that's for, and this is assuming it's just one person. We're talking about tons of people, right? Simultaneously getting all that, getting an idea of what that actually is, and like solidifying that idea, creating a process, and then start putting the tracks on the road for people to start driving. So how are you able to do that, I think, personally, quite quickly then? And what is this communication, that you're able, what are you saying? Is this a spell you're casting?
You know? Let's break that down. right? One of the things that my team does very, very well is they, and this is part of partially because they understand our technology and our organization, right? So they know how to navigate internally across our marketing team and our product teams and our sellers and our sales teams. They understand our own organization and how to navigate, right? They understand the customer organization, the customer problems in each unique customer, in each unique geography. And they learn very quickly. If they don't already know a lot about a partner that's come to the table, they learn very, very quickly about that partner and what motivates them. Internal knowledge of VMware as an organization, external knowledge of the customer and the problems to be solved and the customer's culture, and then the partners and understanding the partners. So when you understand those three things, you anticipate objections.
And so you get an understanding of them before you talk to them?
Oh, yes.
And then are able to make the anticipation? Yes. Okay, got it.
Yes. Like I said, this is not a waterfall kind of
project. It's not a science.
No, this is all, yeah. Everything's connected to everything. So do we walk into situations where we don't have all the information about all three of those things with the exception of our own organization? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oftentimes. But we know that we need to understand that very quickly because in order to be able to execute, the team really needs to anticipate what those objections will be. And 9 times out of 10, if you've worked with an organization, a GSI, an ISV, or a hyperscaler before, you can kind of anticipate what they're going to ask for, what they're...
Sorry, what are those GSI, so ISV,
a global systems
scalers?
Integrator.
Right.
Right. So the consulting companies, the big ones like the Accentures, the Deloittes, the Kindles, the DXCs, the WIP. You can kind of anticipate what they're going to ask for. If you've worked with AWS, Microsoft, Google, Oracle, IBM, the hyperscalers, the cloud providers, Alibaba,
right.
You can anticipate. If you know the industry, you probably know the independent software vendors, ISVs, that will likely be coming to the table, right? So in healthcare in the United States, from an electronic medical record, it's going to be Epic or Imprivata. Right. So you know, you can anticipate what their objections are going to be. You understand who they are, have a conversation with them and deal with those objections, take them out of the equation.
And so you're sort of leveraging that lip gloss you talked about earlier where they market their intentions and then you can leverage that to say, okay, if these are your intentions, here's why you should work with us in this way.
Right. And here's where we want to build you in, and this is what it's going to look like, and we understand how you need to get paid, and so there's a commercial model behind all of those, that entire ecosystem that I just talked about. Now, it's not our job to go in there to those organizations and execute against their commercial model, but it's our job to understand that they have a commercial model and that everybody wants to get a bonus at the end of the year. They want to solve a problem for a customer, don't get me wrong, but they have to do it in a way that aligns with their internal organization. So we know that. And we know that when we build solutions, we have to be very honest. We have to be very transparent. We have to have a very clear understanding of their potential and typical objections. And we really have to style flex. We really have to think about who we're talking to and how we're talking to them in order to convince them to bring their resources to the table. And when we do that really well, oftentimes we'll have partners that will say, you know what, this one's not going to work for me. Sometimes they tell us the reasons and sometimes they don't. This is not a solution that we're going to participate in. Maybe they have a competing solution that they're building with somebody else. Maybe they have their own internal product that they see is a competing solution and they bow out. The good news is, when they tell you that and don't waste your time. The bad news is when they waste your time and pretend that they're going to be involved and really they're not in it.
Something that you said that struck me was, well, first of all, style, I think you call it style flexing.
Style flexing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminded me a little bit of like thinking in accents. I guess there's different sort of like ways to sort of make an analogy, but the, you know, accents or languages or higher, you know, depends how deep in the way of communication you want to assume the change. But what exactly, people talk about corporate speak and all that. And what was super interesting to me when I started this was the different ways that people communicate and how that jargon can cause problems.
Oh yeah.
And how people either very good at switching between jargons or very good at just having a way, a style of communication that's jargon-less. In your style flexing, as you call it, what side are you guys on? Are you more, or I would assume sometimes you probably have to use both because there's multiple people in the room. Mm-hmm. So could you talk a little bit about your ideas on that?
Absolutely. And this is that United Nations Blue Beret, right? The United Nations translator. Because the team shows up, they do have the technical lingo of each industry. They know how to speak to individuals in the customer organization in a language that they will understand. And then they know how to take all of those concepts and bring them back into, let's just take as an example, our VMware product teams, minus all the jargon, and speak in a technical language that our product teams understand. So they bridge that gap between the customer lingo, vernacular, and the product teams and what they need to know in order to be able to execute specifically for that customer, for that industry. And then they also understand how, again, the other partners in the solution speak and think. And so they adapt in the moment. They know when to use the vernacular of their specific industry. And they know when to use the technical language that resonates with partners more specifically who have that technical background. If they're dealing with professional services, global systems integrators teams, they know how to speak their language as well. And so they're kind of constantly adapting and flexing, but they know what the message is. It's just which language they choose to use to communicate it.
Well, something interesting I found was different companies, different skill sets have their own way of communicating. Yeah. Different tiers of individuals have their own ways of communicating within the hierarchy of corporations, and small business people have a way of communicating. Even people in finance, yes, or financing different mm-hmm. business models have their way of communicating. Yep. But the one that everyone has to learn when they start a company, regardless of what they do, is the company's own jargon. Yes. So I've been with companies that use a lot of sort of acronyms. So ATI, this, that, and the other. It might mean something you already know. It's just like they just don't want to write that much, so they use that. You know, it's just
don't want to have to do all that. The four-letter acronyms. Yeah. It's actually, when I onboard to an organization, it's one of the very first things at VMware. When I onboarded, they have a wiki page, an internal wiki page. People constantly add to it. And the interesting thing is, you can have a three or a four-letter acronym that you have used for, let's say, 10 years, and you go to a new company and they're using it to mean something completely different. It's like, oh, wait a minute, time out. You guys are cheating. That's not what it means. You're trying to be extra. Knock it off. Nope. That's what it means in this organization. So I used to work for Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, the oil company. It was acronym alphabet soup every single day. So
that's interesting to hear. So you just have to learn it. So you probably have to learn it every time you started with a new company.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's probably one of the most critical components of onboarding that nobody really builds into their onboarding plan. And what you'll find is that as soon as you join a team, somebody on the team usually will send you a document or a link that says, oh, by the way, you're probably going to want to memorize all of these phrases and understand what these mean. Here you go. It's like, oh, thank you. When I have new people that onboard to my team, that's one of the first things I send them in their welcome email is, you're going to want to know this.
Well, if you were going to send out to the audience a page for them to find you on, where would that page be?
For me, LinkedIn. I usually spend, haven't been as active in the last couple of weeks, but normally I'm on there. My team is definitely on LinkedIn, and obviously VMware is always on LinkedIn.
Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for taking the time to teach us a little bit of what you do and show us how interesting it can be to work with all different kinds of people. And I think I learned a lot. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you this morning, this afternoon for you. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
I will. Take care.